From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment, our connections with and impacts upon it. I'm Chris Cherniak. The planet gains a million people every 4.5 days, or one Park City every hour. In fact, there are more people living in China and India today than lived on the entire planet in 1955. So on a planet that's 70% water and contains finite and in some cases shrinking resources and biodiversity, prospects for a sustainable human future seem ever more in doubt. Author Alan Weissman considered this issue, traveling to more than 20 countries and asking experts the following questions. How many humans can the planet hold, feed, and provide for? And how might we actually arrive at an optimum population and design economies which allow genuine prosperity without endless growth? The result of his efforts is his latest book called Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. The book is being launched in its paperback form today, and it is as urgent and eye-opening as it is hopeful. We'll speak with Alan Weissman in the first part of the show. And in the second half of the show, Daisy Fair from Copper Moose Farms joins us to talk about what's happening at the farm and a special event they're hosting this weekend. All that and some news about brominated vegetable oil and the Keystone Pipeline. What else? It's This Green Earth. And it's the environment, our connections with it, and impacts upon it. That's what This Green Earth is all about. We'll be back right after these words from our underwriters.
This is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage service provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW. Summit County residents are recycling more and more each year in their residential curbside recycling bin. Please help by putting acceptable recyclables in and keeping glass out. Thank you, Summit County. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for?
TED Radio Hour, Sunday morning at 10. Brought to you by Board Docs.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues, our impacts upon relationships with the environment and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Co-host Nell Larson is off today. She'll be back next week. Environmentalists like to talk about many things, clean air, clean water, renewable energy, etc. And in 2007, author Alan Weissman wrote a book titled The World Without Us. It considered how the planet would heal itself in a world suddenly devoid of humans. His latest book is called Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. In fact, Alan could have titled this book The World with Way Too Many of Us, for in it he looks at the effects which population growth, economic growth, and overconsumption are having not only on the planet, but our future as a species as well. What does a stable planet look like through not only the lenses of population and economic growth, but the more abstract notions of consumption and prosperity? Joining us from his home in Massachusetts is author Alan Weissman. Alan, thanks so much for joining us on This Green Earth this morning.
It's a pleasure, Chris.
Hey, let's start here. In the show's opening, I stated, in the research I was doing for this, I came across this fact that there's 2.7 billion people living in China and India today, right? Combined population. That's the same number.
That's about right, yeah.
Yeah, that's the same number of people that lived on the entire planet back in 1955. How did we get from 2.7 billion in 1955 to 7.3 billion today? What happened?
Well, I think the best way to answer that question is to go back to the year 1900.
Mm-hmm.
We human race were at that point at 1.6 billion. We had been way below a billion up until the beginning of the 19th century, when suddenly we got very good at medical advances, starting with a smallpox vaccine and then other vaccines and pasteurization of milk, discovery of the importance of antiseptics, etc. So we crept over a billion. But then two huge things happened in the 20th century that exploded us, first to that mid-century figure that you noted, and then to the point where we're at today. And both of them had to do with food. I call it in Countdown the paradox of food, because it's very counterproductive to or counterintuitive to think that the idea that we can feed many more people somehow then turns on us. The first one that happened was the discovery of a way to pull nitrogen out of the atmosphere artificially and chemically spread it on soil. Artificial nitrogen fertilizer completely blew the lid off of what nature could do before by creating much more plant life than ever existed on this planet. And I mean, just to give you an idea of how important that was, 40% of us just would not be here if it wasn't for artificial nitrogen. That, you know, incredibly increased the number of humans who could survive. And that got us into the middle of the century, where people were already starting to talk about this incredible population growth, because we were near, as you say, you know, some 3 billion people by then.
Right.
And, in fact, President Eisenhower appointed one of his allied commanding generals to study the question, a guy named William Draper, who then devoted the rest of his life to the issue of population, because, as Eisenhower reported from Draper's findings, he said that in the post-war era, which we're still a part, the single biggest threat to global security was going to be overpopulation.
Wow.
Well, then we get into the 1960s, and we're over 3.5 billion, and Paul and Ann Ehrlich wrote the book called The Population Bomb, which said that basically, you know, Malthus's predictions of population running far ahead of food production were coming true, and we were going to have huge famines. But then those famines were suddenly avoided by the second big agricultural miracle, which we call the Green Revolution, in which plants were developed, grains, that could produce many more wheat berries or grains of rice per stalk than nature could previously through genetic selection. Selection.
Right.
And those plants were taken to first to Asia and specifically to India and neighboring Pakistan, which were on the verge of famine. And instead of dying of famine, suddenly, you know, those people survived to beget more children, who, of course, survived to beget more children. So now China, or India, is about to surpass China as the most populous nation on the earth, And Pakistan is one of the fastest growing and one of the scariest. We can talk more about it. Both countries are countries that I visited along with China in researching Countdown.
Okay, so we'll get it. So it's a combination of advances in technology plus nitrogen-based fertilizers, or synthetically produced nitrogen-based fertilizers, and the Green Revolution, Norman Borlaug and his efforts that resulted in this exponential increase in population. So the question then becomes, how many people can the planet hold? I mean, what were the Ehrlich's numbers? What is the common number? I know it's a tough one to talk about, but what were your findings there?
Well, I discussed it in a couple of places there, but since you mentioned Norman Borlaug, I want to interject here that many people say that Norman Borlaug, who was the founder of the Green Revolution, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for saving more human lives than anybody in history, disproved Malthus and disproved the Ehrlichs, saying that the planet could hold all kinds of people, because we have the technology to feed everybody. When Borlaug accepted the Nobel Peace Prize, he did not say that we had eliminated hunger. He said that we postponed the situation for a generation. Mm-hmm. And he ended his speech by saying that unless our advances in food production and our advances in population control join together, we are going to be in a desperate situation. The optimum number of people on the planet, I look at a couple different ways in this book. One of them was determined by how much carbon dioxide could the atmosphere safely hold without destabilizing. And that's a calculation that was made by President Obama's science advisor back in the 1990s when he was a physicist and is one of the most garlanded scientists in the United States, John Holdren. And he was trying to figure out, given everybody having an acceptable lifestyle on the planet, what would be the minimum amount of carbon dioxide we could get away with, given that 80% of our energy comes out of CO2, and we're not going to be changing that anytime soon, unfortunately, or it produces CO2.
Right.
And the figure came down to somewhere between 1.5 and 2 billion. Now, people who have tried to calculate it through looking at agriculture also note that 2 billion is the population before nitrogen fertilizer became extensively commercialized. In other words, that's before we started force-feeding our food supply with chemistry in two ways. First of all, the artificial nitrogen has all kinds of negative impacts. It's made from fossil fuels and takes a lot of energy to make it.
Right.
It sterilizes soils, it fouls downstream waters, and it leaves chunks of the ocean at the mouths of our world's great rivers, chunks the size of New Jersey, dead.
Dead zones, right.
Yeah. Plus, and when it degrades, it becomes nitrous oxide, which after methane is the third most powerful greenhouse gas. The Green Revolution crops, which are fertilized heavily with nitrogen, since they're developed in laboratories, they didn't evolve in nature, they need artificial protection against pests and diseases. And so that involves even more chemistry, which now scientists and doctors are connecting the dots to cognitive disorders, to breast cancer, to autism, to Parkinson's disease, to a whole host of problems that we're seeing more and more of. And it's not just that we're getting better at reporting of them. There seems to be a direct connection to the fact that we spread poison
right
in order to feed ourselves. So if we go back to a time when we weren't doing that, we also arrive at a figure of around 2 billion as an optimum figure. Now, I don't recommend in Countdown that we start culling people to get to that figure, nor that we do something as drastic as the Chinese did, which nobody seems to like. But
right,
fortunately, I was able to find all kinds of examples of how population can come down on a voluntary basis because people begin to realize that it's in their own self-interest and their family's interest to have fewer kids.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute. You had a chance to travel around the world to interview folks and experience different cities and locales. What were some of the things you came away with respect to overpopulation? What were some of the more overpopulated places you visited?
Well, I mentioned Pakistan before. Like India, Pakistan got the Green Revolution and people didn't die. Unfortunately, as a result of that, Pakistan is now approaching 200 million people, and that's in a country that's roughly the size of Texas, which has 26 million people. And by the middle of this century, if growth continues apace, it will have close to 400 million people, which is many more than the United States has today, and it'll still be the size of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And its economy cannot possibly keep up with population growth, so it's a country that is filled with under- or unemployed, frustrated young men, and they, of course, become an easy breeding ground for what we call terrorism in the United States. It, to me, it is the epitome of what Eisenhower was talking about when he called overpopulation the greatest security risk, because, you know, on top of everything that I just described, we have to remember that Pakistan is a nuclear power, and it's the reason why North Korea has nuclear weapons today. So a country that is out of control, and that country is, I mean, when I was there, there was just mayhem in the streets of Karachi every day. Two of the people who I went to interview who had been trying to save the mangrove forests around Karachi Harbor, I got there a day late because they were found tortured and floating and in the harbor. They'd been assassinated by people who wanted to cut the mangroves. So this comes to bite us in many, many unexpected ways. And it's unexpected because we don't realize that we are part of the most abnormal population growth in the history of biology, other than a few explosions, microbial explosions.
Right.
No other terrestrial species of any size has gotten so out of balance with the rest of nature.
Bacteria in a petri dish are jealous. That's part of us. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if they're paying attention to us, but unfortunately, we're not paying much attention to ourselves.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. Let me just say that if you just joined us, you're listening to This Green Earth on KPCW in Park City, and I'm speaking with Alan Weissman, author of Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. It's a great book. It was recently the winner of the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, and it's available in paperback starting today. You can't talk about population, Alan, without talking about fertility rates. And you're actually starting to see fertility rates to drop in a number of countries, and a number of countries have negative replacement rates. We can get to a couple examples, but overall, are fertility rates declining?
Fertility rates are now declining in about half the countries of the world, which is a good sign.
Yeah.
And they're declining for very good reasons. One thing that I found wherever I went, rich country or poor country, that the best contraception of all is educating females. Whenever you've got educated women, a girl will tend to postpone her childbearing while she's studying, and then once she's done, she's got something interesting and useful and economically helpful to her family to do with that education, but it's impossible with seven kids hanging on you. So the overwhelming average of for women with high school and beyond is two children or fewer. Two children is replacement rate. You use that word, that means two people have two kids essentially replacing themselves. So anytime someone has two kids, population doesn't increase. If they have fewer, then population starts coming down. The other reason that fertility is decreasing is that many countries have realized that it's in their best interest to have fewer children.
Right.
The Chinese famously understood that after they had a famine that killed nearly 40 million people, possibly more, but they used a drastic method that nobody likes, including the Chinese. But I have several examples in the book of countries who came up with some remarkably intelligent voluntary programs that each one quite distinct from each other because it was appropriate for the culture of that country.
Right.
If you'd like, I can give you a couple of examples.
Yeah, let's talk about Iran.
Yeah, Iran is really interesting, of course, because one of the places that I went for this book was Europe, where there's a lot of fear among, quote, traditional Europeans, meaning white people, that Muslims are going to, immigrate to the country and they're going to proliferate like bunnies and all of Europe is going to become a Muslim nation. You know, the same kind of fears about Latin Americans are oftentimes expressed in the United States. As it happens, those immigrant kids, and they may be from a family of eight, but once they get into schools, then their fertility rate drops just as suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
As people who have been there for a few generations. In Iran, the situation was, it's a great example of an entire Muslim country, and there it's not the only one. There are three other Muslim countries that are below replacement right now. But Iran's case was fascinating because in 1979, they had their Islamic Revolution, and then they were immediately attacked by Saddam Hussein. He wanted to grab this oil-rich province on their border, much like he went after Kuwait 10 years later. And he figured that, they'd just overthrown a century's worth of dynasties. It would be easy picking.
Right.
Plus, he had the backing of NATO. He had sophisticated weaponry. All the Iranians had was bodies. So the Ayatollah at the time asked every Iranian woman to do her patriotic duty, fertile women, to get pregnant, to help build a 20-million-man army to fight off the invaders.
Right.
And for 8 years, they held the Iraqis to a stalemate. And then when a truce was finally brokered, the economist who was head of planning and budget for the country went to the Ayatollah and said, we have a terrible problem because all those kids who were born during that, that fertility bubble, in 10, 15 years, they're going to want jobs. And they basically said, we're going to be in the same state situation as Pakistan. And, we're going to have a destabilized country.
Right.
So the Ayatollah okayed the idea of family planning, and then he died, and the current Ayatollah issued a fatwa saying that there was nothing in the Quran that says if wisdom dictates that you've got the number of children you can responsibly care for, there's nothing against using any kind of birth control, including operations for men and women. Then they made all those things available for free throughout the country. I interviewed a very devout Muslim OBGYN, a woman who told me how they would go horseback to the farthest villages, bringing everything from condoms to tubal ligations and vasectomies. The only thing that was obligatory, people could have as many children as they want, but they had to attend premarital classes. And in those classes, among other things, you learned how much does it cost to raise, feed, clothe, and educate a child. And people got the idea. And then the last one was that they encouraged women to stay in school. 60% of university students today in Iran are female. And as a result, Iran's fertility rate came down below replacement a year faster than China's. So
using religion as a compelling method, using religion to compel people to recognize the value of population control and fertility.
Well, a lot of people think about religion as being against population control because be fruitful and multiply is how every culture in the world starts off. It's a strategy to have a lot of kids. So you're going to be more powerful than the competing cultural group. But in every, I interviewed religious leaders all over the world, and every religion, there are accommodations for the idea of the times it's not really helpful.
Right.
For example, in our Judeo-Christian religion, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were all polygamous for the same reasons Mormons were later on. It's that strategy to grow really big and powerful as quickly as possible. But you get down to the fourth generation, and Joseph, one of Jacob's 13 children, realizes that there are times, and this was a time that nature was entering into a cycle of scarcity. So he only has one wife and two children, and he consults the Pharaoh of Egypt and the Israelites that now is not a time to expand. it's literally a time to refrain from embracing so much. It's time to conserve. And I think that our world is now in one of those situations. This is a time that in order to ensure a future for ourselves, we're already starting to feel the effects of our pressure on the planet. And it's a time to start refraining from embracing so much. Unfortunately, this is one of the fastest things that we can do to reduce human impact on the planet, and it's one of the cheapest.
Right. Well, let's localize it a bit. You had a chance to talk to Mormons here in Utah and talk about their story and how they recognized that fertility rates needed to come down.
Well, you know, I brought up this issue at the end of The World Without Us because I really wrote that book because I want a world with us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wanted to just theoretically remove us from the planet, see how nature could respond, and then have people say, well, how can we add ourselves back into this picture only in harmony and not in constant combat with nature? So when I was on book tour for that book, I had several speaking engagements in Utah, from Park City all the way up to Ogden, and I had some Mormon audiences, and so I thought, well, how are they going to respond to this?
Mm-hmm.
And some research showed me that at the beginning of the 20th century, the Mormons already had responded to it, because in their fruitful and multiply period, of course, they were being polygamous for the same reason most other cultures are. But then polygamy was outlawed in the United States, or it was already against the law, and they had to accept that. But Mormon men kept impregnating their wives to have a lot of children, and suddenly there was a crisis. Many women were dying because they were getting pregnant too soon after their last pregnancy. Fortunately, the Mormons are very good at emphasizing the importance of education, and there was a
right.
generation of young Mormon doctors who were starting to counsel women to say that, you know, for the good of both your family and for our family-based religion, you have to learn to space your births, because, you know, a family without a mother is a family at risk, and that kind of save the day. So when I spoke to Mormon audiences, I said, you know, not only do you have this precedent within your religion, but also you being a religion that is not tied to these ancient liturgies, you're a modern Christian religion with your Book of Mormon. In some ways, you're more flexible to respond to a time that we maybe, in order to save Mother Nature, we have to start spacing births even more. And the reception was extremely warm.
Right.
Sold a lot of books and all those.
Put it in terms of moms, and you get their attention. That's a good way of doing it.
Well,
moms and mothers, and that's what we have out here. We do a lot of grassroots efforts in clean air and air quality, and we have a group here that's not just clean air for Utah. It's moms. Moms for Clean Air, Utah. So, you know,
well, I met some of those women when I was there, and everyone I talked to was completely upset that there's now like a strip city that goes from, you know, Ogden to Provo,
mm-hmm.
and that sometimes you can't even see the ski slopes because the air is so bad.
Oh yeah,
and of course, you know, you're in the Colorado River watershed. I've been writing for years about the oversubscription of the Colorado River, and now with a combination of shale oil mining in Wyoming down to the reduced snowpack in the Rockies, I mean, we're looking at a time that we need to conserve in order to continue to be a viable species on this planet, one that is not out of balance with the rest of nature.
Well,
there's no other way around it. One way or another, our population is going to have to come down. Either we're going to manage it gracefully, or nature is going to do it for us.
Well, population, right? It has to be a combination of a sweet spot of maybe population dropping, numbers themselves dropping, but consumption also being addressed. And that's a more abstract issue. isn't it, when you're trying to, you know, convince people that maybe we don't need to consume as much resources and still have a life that we can consider prosperous, you know? And so is it possible to kind of control economic growth and maybe revisit our definition of economic growth and prosperity and still be prosperous?
Well, it is. I mean, I have a whole chapter in this book about how Japan, which
right.
already has a shrinking population due to historical reasons, they had to cut off their baby boom at the end of World War II because they lost the war and people were starving to death.
Mm-hmm.
So they legalized abortion. That was back before the pill. And now they're shrinking and they're learning how, time doesn't permit us to go into all the details here, but they're learning how to adjust to a smaller population, and it's going to mean lighter, more domestic industries instead of heavy export industries, which means that people can move inland into some of these lands that are being vacated as that last dying over in a huge generation that was born before World War II. And by the way, we should remember that both Japan and Germany got into World War II. They started it because they had growing, overgrown populations mm-hmm. that they wanted to expand elsewhere. As a Japanese, the vice president of the Japanese Senate said, you know, a smaller population and an aging population, which they have right now, is a much more peaceful generation. They don't tend to go to war. And, you know, younger people are moving back into the hinterlands, rediscovering agriculture. So lighter industries are following them back there. The hinterlands are cheaper now because so many people are passing away. It's actually it's a kind of a nice economic vision for the future because with less demand as there are fewer people, that means that working hours are just going to shorten, and Japanese have been working crazy hours during their economic boom. So they're starting to see a lot of the benefits, plus not necessarily having to have so many nuclear plants in very fragile, you know, precarious situations to fuel all that economic growth.
Right. And in some sense, a world without a scenario surrounding Fukushima, which is probably another chapter to a world without us in that sense, you know, that place has been abandoned for now. It would be interesting to see how the environment has kind of taken back.
Well, the way of bringing population down shouldn't have to be through Fukushima's and Chernobyl's that cause everybody to flee.
Yes.
You know, I want to make two points here. You mentioned consumption, and a lot of people have said to me, well, isn't consumption the problem, not population?
Right.
And look, it doesn't matter very – I mean, first of all, as Paul Ehrlich points out, there's no condom for consumption. We don't really know how to control consumption. It's just something that, you know, that people tend to do, and yes, we can be more conscious about it. But fact is, we're all addicted to two things that overwhelm the environment when our population is this high. One, we're addicted to energy. And right now, 80% of it's based on carbon-based fuels, and there's more carbon dioxide as a result in our atmosphere than there've been in 3 million years. When 3 million years ago, the seas were 80 to 100 feet higher. Number two, we're all addicted to food.
Yeah,
and it doesn't matter how modest a lifestyle is. People need to grow food. 40% of the non-frozen terrestrial planet is now devoted to feeding just one species, and that's us, which means that we're pushing all these other species off the planet. We are right now experiencing a faster extinction of biodiversity than has taken place since that asteroid crashed into the Yucatan and did away with the dinosaurs and 60% of everything else that was alive.
Right.
We cannot continue like this, because sooner or later we're going to eliminate some species that we didn't know until it's too late that we needed that one, and then we're going to go too.
Well, so last word, are you hopeful? I mean, we're at 7.3 billion. We're going to be at 8 billion within the next 10 years. Carrying capacity seems to be somewhere around 2.5, let's say 3 billion.
Look, I have many examples in this book of countries. I mean, we just mentioned Iran, but there are several others ranging from Mexico to Thailand to Bangladesh who have all brought their fertility rates down in a surprisingly short period of time below replacement rate. Interestingly, all those programs were started by visionaries who happened to be economists who realized that at a certain point, the number of people just overwhelms not just ecology, but economy, and destabilizes a country. To provide contraception to the entire world so people could make the decision for themselves, meaning no government telling you that you have to do it, people deciding for themselves, that would cost less per year, about $8.1 billion, than the United States was spending per month in Afghanistan and Iraq during most of the last decade. I mean, this is totally affordable, and it's technology we already have. It doesn't involve magically creating renewable energy tomorrow that will replace fossil fuels. And this is something that over the next couple of generations, which would give us time to gradually readjust to a shrinking economy, we can do to bring ourselves gracefully down to a sustainable balance with the rest of nature. So I came out of this book more hopeful than when I went into it. It's not going to be easy, but nothing in the 21st century will be.
Nothing is. The name of the book is Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. It's available in paperback starting today. Alan Weissman is the author. Great book, Alan. Really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me on This Green Earth this morning, and hope to see you out here in Utah sometime.
Well, thanks so much, Chris. I would love to go back to Utah again.
All right. Hey, we'll be in touch. Let's thanks again, and let's take a break for some underwriters. And when we come back, we've got Daisy Fair on from Copper Moose Farms. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Foothill Oriental Rugs has been an underwriter on KPCW for over 20 years. I'm Jim Weber, owner, rug buyer, and Park City resident. As a direct importer since 1985, from traditional to contemporary to tribal, Foothill Oriental Rugs is Utah's complete rug source. Foothill Oriental Rugs is located 2 miles north of the mouth of the canyon in Salt Lake City at 1460 Foothill Drive.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth. Rocky Mountain Power offers watt-smart advice such as avoiding the use of large appliances like a washer or dryer between 2 and 8 p.m. because it helps reduce energy demand and keeps costs down for all of us. More ways to save energy at wattsmart.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. And joining me in the studio for this segment is Ethel Preston.
Hello.
And Daisy Fair from Copper Moose Farms.
Good morning.
Chief Farmer.
Yeah. Head slave.
Head slave, COF, Chief Organic Farmer at Daisy Farm, at Copper Moose Farms.
Copper Moose Farms.
I'm ahead of myself.
Yep. Right.
So, let's start here. You know, we'll get to you got an event coming up. We'll talk about that. But you just heard at least a portion of my conversation with Alan Weissman, and we talked at, population, and of course he says food was a huge reason why population grew in an exponential fashion. The production of food. First of all, he talked about two things. Synthetically produced nitrogen and infusing that into the soil, and that just kind of supercharged food production. And then Norman Borlaug and the Green Revolution and his efforts there to produce wheat, rice, corn that grew, let's say, under otherwise stressful conditions, drought conditions. So do you follow along with that? Is that something that
Well, I mean, of course, as a grower, you know, have that the back knowledge on that, and then it always rolls through my head if you know, when you get those emails from family members who are very focused on the demise of the planet and what's mm-hmm. going to happen when it all goes wrong, and I think, what would we change at Copper Moose to ensure food mm-hmm. security for X number of people? And you know, you change what you grow. You really focus on more calorie dense crops and a lot of them, instead of having, you know, lettuces and microgreens and, you know, stuff like that.
Arugula.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, tomatoes for that point. You know, you really focus on, let's say, potatoes and the root crops, and garlic is really calorie dense, and transitioning some stuff over into some of the grains that'll grow up here. So it's a change of focus into survival instead of enjoyment as much. And, you know, and health. I think all of those countries that, you know, pre-Green Revolution, you mean, look at the Irish, they grew a lot of potatoes. Yeah. And the Peruvians are still growing a lot of potatoes because they're calorie dense and they'll store throughout the winter. And so it would be a big change. I think you go back to more of a smaller vegetable garden that you have for diversity. And then larger operation would be growing grains and calorie dense foods.
Right.
Very different focus. And probably bringing in some more animals as well. On the land. Not a huge amount, but you know, you need to get some milk going, and would definitely change the focus. And you know, how many people could be supported off of, currently we only grow on 3 acres, so not many people can be supported off 3 acres.
No.
But the whole parcel is much larger and not mine to play with. But that's, you know, you look at the size of land that you need to support how many people year round.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, just supporting a town like this.
Right.
9,000-10,000 people?
Right. I mean, I don't know.
How many acres?
You know, when you take down the calories per day that people need to survive and how many acres you need to grow those calories per day. And I don't know those calculations.
Okay.
And I hope I don't learn them.
Don't have to
learn.
I hope I don't have to learn them.
Right. You prefer not. Okay.
I guess it would be an interesting thing to know, but.
But it is a testimonial to science, ability to provide. Well, I shouldn't say provide, but where Alan was talking about carrying capacity, and you know, the scientists, researchers suggest 2 to 2.5 billion people is probably the comfortable carrying capacity of the planet's resources, you know, the pantry, the planet's pantry. And here we are at 7.3, not that all are being provided for,
right.
And that's a critical part of that. You know, there are billions of people who don't have enough food, water, shelter, clothing, mm-hmm. et cetera. There are billions of us that do. But it is at least a testimonial of that fact that the Green Revolution and advanced techniques in farming have provided tremendous amounts of food. Otherwise, not necessarily all good for us either.
I was going to say, double-edged sword, and what, you know, the unintended consequences of that, as he was talking about.
Well, the majority of, let's say, the corn that we grow in this country goes to producing cattle feed, producing high fructose corn syrup, and producing fuel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's virtually inedible, mm-hmm. right? The corn in the Midwest. So mm-hmm. so we have our, you know, priorities backwards at time with respect to food. But you guys don't over at Copper Moose, I assume, right?
Well, I think we're doing it right, or as right as we can.
And you want to showcase that and share that with the community. So what's happening?
Yeah. So once a year, we have an open house, and that's coming up on Saturday, this Saturday, from 1 to 3. And we bring everybody in. We bring in our solar people to talk about our solar systems.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
sir.
Yeah. We have our apiarist, our bee guy, Doug, will be there. All of our staff will be there. This year, we're also inviting all of our kind of community partnerships that we have with other food producers in the community. So our beef guy will be there. Tailor Made Beef is coming up. And then we'll also have Beehive Cheese, perhaps a couple others as well. So I think it'll be just a fun afternoon. It's a great time. We just open the place up. And like I said, we only do this once a year because generally we're not open to the public. So this is time for people to come out and learn about everything we've got going on there, all of our greenhouses and our, you know, poultry flock and the bees and all the veggies.
It's a great little science
I saw you
fair.
There last year.
I was there.
You come last year?
I spent, I think, from 1 to 3 just staring at the bees.
At the bees. That's, you know, a lot of people
I got to the beehive,
don't get much farther than the bees.
Well, you know, Larry says I'm obsessed, but I really would love us to have a beehive on top of our flat roof building.
Yeah, Doug will be there on Saturday.
I think that would be so wonderful here in Old Town.
Oh, Okay.
It's a perfect place. The building juts out.
Right.
The bees could take off.
You're right.
Linus
and there's flowers all around.
No, I just liked watching them. You know,
they're
coming
amazing.
in and coming and going. And
Doug, the fact
trying to communicate with each other. And Doug's just the font of information.
He is, and he's so fun and presents it in such a digestible way also.
Exactly. Exactly. So he'll be there.
He'll be there.
Like you said, cheese people and beef people and solar guys.
Yep.
Is it an opportunity for people to sign up with the farm?
Well, our CSA is full again this year. But we're very excited because we are going to be opening a farm stand this year right on Old Ranch Road. And that's going to be happening in July. And so we will be open to the public. The farm stand will be open to the public. Yeah, I know.
Tuesday, first come, first serve.
First come, first serve. Tuesday and Thursday afternoons, 3 to 6 right now. We'll see how those hours work. And then Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. So we're just grateful that for the first time ever we can say come buy our produce, everybody. So that's pretty exciting for us.
And also, where's it going to be located?
It's right on Old Ranch Road.
Old Ranch Road.
It's on the farm property. It's on Old Ranch Road, and it's going to be right across the street from the Willow Creek Park and neighborhood entrance. So yeah, can't miss it. And I'll be putting up updates on our website and also on our Facebook page, which is Copper Moose Farm, so that people will be abreast of the situation and what will be there each week. And so we're pretty excited about that.
Excellent.
Yeah, and I have an announcement and a question. Daisy brought me a cherry tomato plant. And my question is, what do I do with it?
What now?
But, I mean, it doesn't have – it's baby.
Right.
So I have to nurse it to get it to
grow. I would assume.
So I need her – you know, what do I do?
Well, first you should come on Saturday morning to the farm. Summit Community Gardens is hosting another class at the farm on Saturday morning from 9 to 11, and it'll be on season extension, which helps out a lot with the, I call them the glam crops, those glamorous crops. You know, they're the ones everybody want. They're real flashy and good looking, and they're high maintenance.
What's a glam crop?
A glam crop. Well, like your cherry tomato.
Oh, it's a glam?
That's a mediocre glam, you know, glamorous glam crop.
Yeah, right.
So learning how to deal with those glam crops that are high maintenance and need extra attention.
High maintenance in terms of water,
It doesn't like our climate that much here. So you need to do some extra things to coax them along.
Drive it down to Salt Lake City.
Drive it to Salt Lake every day.
What?
You have shopping. That's what it likes. Well, you know, some season extension practices, and that's what the class is going to be about, is basic season extension practices that'll help out with things such as cherry tomatoes, basil, the stuff that everybody wants, but also just getting crops earlier in the year, or let's say broccoli, which can also, you know, there's some crops that need some help up here. So, and there's very basic things you can do, and then there's very glamorous things that you can do. And we'll kind of be covering the easy stuff, the basic stuff, and touching on some of the more glamorous stuff.
All right, so Ethel, you can learn all about.
She's already told me that I have to get it used to the outdoors gradually, and that if it's half indoors, half out, I will have to fertilize?
Yeah, so if you are growing your tomatoes or peppers or anything like that inside, any of those fruiting crops, you do have to hand pollinate, which doesn't mean much. We're not talking like tweezers and you know, Q-tips or anything like
they do
like
in
that.
China.
No. You just tap them. But if you are growing crops inside, they're a fruiting crop like that, you will need to hand pollinate because there's no wind, there's no rain, there's no, you know, not enough bugs to help pollinate and spread the pollen around. So it sounds very complicated and over the hill, but it's just it's another one of those glam crop requirements. It's a little hand pollination.
Tapping.
All right. And several hundred pounds of manure is never a bad idea. Right? That's what
synthetic nitrogen.
Exactly. Which you don't use. Okay. Let's talk about, obviously you don't use synthetic nitrogen in your crops. Mm-hmm. Pesticides, herbicides. Avoid those things.
Yes.
Synthetically.
Right.
Synthetic
types. Yeah. Synthetic types we're not allowed to use. So, you know, there are other sources of nitrogen for our farm, it gets more expensive. Finding more of the protein-based nitrogens are more expensive. But they're better to use overall. You know, you're not dealing with a runoff problem. They're a slow release because they're protein-based, the microbes in the soil need to break down the nitrogen before it's accessible to the plant. So it's a slower process, a slower release. You're not dealing with runoff problems. But on a business side, it's more expensive. So that's one of the commitments that we make to grow our food organically, is that we're spending more money on supplements like that and amendments.
What's a protein?
But then we can also produce our own nitrogen. We grow a lot of cover crops. So cover crops, certain cover crops, the legumes, will produce nitrogen and plenty of it in the soil as long as you have, you know, enough time to let the cover crop mature and grow before you get your crop in. So we do a balance of both.
These are farm practices that have been around for decades, if not centuries.
The Native Americans planting their Three Sisters garden on top of an old dead fish, right? Because that was the slow-release nitrogen. Mm-hmm. So they'd put the fish in there, some soil, the seeds, covered up, hope it rained. And the dead fish in there was providing nutrients and nitrogen for the crops.
And the Three Sisters are the three different...
Corn, beans, and squash.
Squash.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So these are, again, these are methods that have been practiced for centuries. But
and
like
successful.
You say... And successful, but they don't produce the food at the rates that we need them. And that's where...
Well, that's debatable, I would say. Because I think if you're looking longer term and down the road, we are destroying our soils.
Okay.
And you can only do so much before you have completely nuked the soils and there's nothing left for us there. So this chemical agriculture is successful, quote-unquote successful, right now. But I'm not convinced that it can last much longer. And so there is this, you know, eco-agricultural practices that are far more sustainable and produce plenty of food. And you're not having an entire crop wiped out by one, you know, insect invasion because that crop is completely dependent on an insecticide that, you know, the insects have now modified so that it doesn't affect them anymore. It's far more complicated than just saying we can't feed our populations with organic practices because that is being proved wrong. Now.
Okay.
Yeah?
Good. I'm glad you brought that. And, but here's another... leg to this stool is the fact that we as consumers need to maybe change our behaviors and our expectations that we need to have every type of food here in the U.S., at least every type of food at any time of the day or season, and get back to an acceptance of seasonality. You know, again, I go to the supermarkets here and there is no less than 10 different types of apples that I could choose from. 12 months out of the year.
Yep.
Now they're being flown in from different parts of the world and, you know, seven of them are I wouldn't eat, you know, because they're pretty much inedible. But yet that's what we've come to expect.
Right.
Oranges, 12 months out of the year. God forbid if I didn't have fresh limes in the middle of February, you know, for whatever reason.
Yeah.
We have to change our behavior and our acceptance that it's okay. It's okay if there's only four different varieties of apples and maybe 8 months out of the year.
Yep.
God forbid if we went 4 months without out. You know, it's all right. Mm-hmm. So we have to change our behaviors and our expectations in that area too.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm. All right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. Is that anything else again?
If people are interested in the class, first off, they can go to summitcommunitygardens.org and figure out how to sign up for it on our website there. Mm-hmm. And then the event or our open house at Copper Moose from 1 to 3. You can check out our website, coppermoosefarm.com. If you have any questions, you can email me right through the site or check out our Facebook page where there's info on there. And we can continue the conversation at the farm.
We'll be there.
Great.
And
thanks, guys.
I will tap my tomato plant.
Once it gets flowers.
Flowers. Yeah.
Perfect. Daisy Fair at Copper Moose Farm. So thank you so much for coming by.
Thanks for having me, Chris. Appreciate it.
Anytime. Let's take a break for our last underwriters and we'll come back to wrap up. It's This Green Earth.
This is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage service provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW. Summit County residents are recycling more and more each year in their residential curbside recycling bin. Please help by putting acceptable recyclables in and keeping glass out. Thank you, Summit County. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. Low Stump Tree Service, Park City's Local Tree Care, 435-200-5730. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
That's it for this week's show. I thank our underwriters for whom this show would not be possible. They include Republic Services, Habitat for Humanity's Restore, Vail Resorts, Rocky Mountain Power, San Francisco Design, and Prudential Utah Real Estate. You can join us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth. And, of course, you can join us every Tuesday, if you like, here on KPCW. Nell will be back next week. This is KPCW 91.9 FM, Park City. only in Park City, only on KPCW.